Good morning. My name is Charles Cotillo. I'm with New Book Network, the History Division. Today we are pleased and honored to have Professor Emeritus of Commonwealth History at Cambridge University, Anthony Hopkins. Professor Hopkins is a widely acknowledged specialist on the economics of British imperialism in the 19th and 20th centuries. Today we are to discuss his new book, American Empire, Global History. Professor Hopkins, first thing, what may one say is the thesis of your book?
Yes, thank you very much, Charles. And let me begin by thanking you for taking my work so seriously and giving me the opportunity to discuss it with you and with all those who follow the network. So the main thesis of this book, which is rather big, can be summarized as follows, that in the 19th and 20th centuries, the trajectory of the United States, that's to say the course of its historical evolution, has typically been seen as being largely independent of other Western developments, at least after independence in 1783, down to approximately Pearl Harbor in 1941, which is, of course, a very long stretch of history. My argument, on the contrary, is that the United States history during this time, not in particulars, but in terms of its broad evolution, should be seen as part of an evolving Western imperial system. And I use the term imperial here in a non-ideological way. That is to say, I'm looking at the expansion of these great territorial empires during the period from, let us say, 1700 to their demise in 1950 as being a huge transformative development. The costs and benefits, the morality and so on, are not matters that I have chosen to discuss in this particular book. So that is the essence of the, at least the approach to my book and its thesis.
You begin your book with the recounting of the British defeat in 1916 in the Battle of Kut in what is today Iraq, then Ottoman Mesopotamia. Why so?
Yes. Well, thank you. That is perhaps, at first sight anyway, a rather odd choice to begin a book on the United States by talking about an obscure episode in the history of the British Empire when it was, as some people think, towards its close. The point is that this episode, in which there was a crisis and something of a disaster for British military power, has been seen as a turning point between, from the British point of view, the rise of empire and its expansion from the 1800s down to the First World War, and after then the story changes. It's no longer one of expansion, it is one of grappling with nationalism and then inevitable decline. That's the British side. But I try to show that the US side is introduced into this because the episode has been seen as a turning point for the United States too. Books have been written under the title Heir to Empire, in which it's argued that this is the point where the United States in 1917 comes into the battle, and that's the origin of what we later know as the rise of the superpower in the later 20th century. So the two things do come together, and I use their joint appearance in the literature to discuss the whole question of what kinds of comparisons can be made. That is to say, what we're talking about here is the trajectory of the United States, its history over nearly three centuries, but also how it might stand in relation to that of the other great Western powers, and specifically the other great Western empires, of which by far the most important was Britain. So that interaction of the two during the First World War, the two great powers as they were becoming, that during that time can be used as a point of departure, suggesting the whole question of similarity and possible contrast, of course, during the period of, that I am covering. May I add to that, that if you fast forward then to the epilogue, which I am particularly pleased with, because it was, I wanted to find an epilogue which complemented the starting point. So I chose an event in the invasion of Iraq, which began in March 2003. And of course, I wanted to find something going on in Kut with the United States, as it was with the British in 1915. But Kut was not well known. It was a small city, a small village in 1915, quite a big town in 2003. But it was not known, like Fallujah and Mosul and so on, as a scene of a big battle. And it took me ages, and I nearly despaired and gave up, until I stumbled across some work by journalists which directed me to Kut in 2003. So the episode I begin with in Iraq during the First World War, where I focus upon a British army and so on, is complemented in 2003 by my focus on the United States those years later entering Kut as part of a second invasion. So what I do in the epilogue, if I may just fast forward to underline the point I tried to make with regard to the prologue and the whole thesis of the book, is to say that at first sight, these two things look very similar. You've got the fog of war, you've got an invasion by a foreign power, and so on. But what I'm arguing, and this comes through, I hope, very much in the epilogue, is to say, despite the apparent similarities at first sight, the underlying conditions, the broad international context in which the Western empires had flourished during the era of the British, and also during the era of the U.S. territorial empire, the islands that it acquired in the Caribbean and Pacific from 1898 to the 1950s, that had come to an end, and that underlying the apparent similarities were marked changes in the world order, which, in my view, made the creation of new empires or the expansion of the old ones impossible.
Which, regardless of that, overall, your assessment is that you're, at the very least, a skeptic in relation to the concept of so-called American exceptionalism. Why so?
Yes. The argument there, and I have to be quite concise about this, because a lot has been written about American exceptionalism. It'd be easy to write yet another book showing that, that the exceptionalism of the United States was one of the particularity distinctiveness rather than of some separate mission. And I didn't want to go into all of that. I have to mention the notion of exceptionalism, because everyone does who writes in this area. But I try to argue that what really matters is not criticizing exceptionalism, but trying to find something that stands in its place. And that is where I've actually made a case for a kind of unexceptionalism of aspects, international aspects of the U.S. historical experience. So the question then I try to talk about in this area, without going into exceptionalism in great detail, is to say one has to distinguish between what you might call an ideological exceptionalism, in which there is a belief in a particular mission, and a form of exceptionalism, which you can't use the term to describe, namely, that draws attention to the distinctiveness of the United States. So exceptionalism in the ideological sense is very difficult to sustain. Exceptionalism in the sense of distinctiveness of the United States in many respects is, of course, something that has to be acknowledged quite happily. And the point here, to conclude this observation, is that when you look around the world, at Britain, at France, at Russia, at Japan, all of these countries countries and others, have an exceptionalist ideological myth or image or mission of their own. So exceptionalism, as the United States conceives, is not in itself exceptional. Other great powers also think they have a great mission. And secondly, other great powers also have their particularities. So in a way, I'm trying to disallow one form of exceptionalism and allowing what I'm calling, to stop a confusion, the distinctiveness of the United States. But having said that, if I'm not being too confusing, then that puts the United States on a par with all the other great powers, which also have an ideological sense of mission, which cannot be proved, and are distinctive in their own right.
Why do you believe that, quote, globalization and empires are interlinked, unquote?
Well, there are many ways in which globalization, many agents of globalization, many ways it has been and can be spread. The argument that I make here is not to disavow other agents and motives and impulses, those of pilgrims, those of the movement of disease, those of the movement or spread of religions, for example. That, of course, is all important, and many other things too. But the main point is to say that during this period, that is from 1800 to about 1950, the most important, the most widespread, penetrative of these global influences was the agency brought about by the creation and expansion of territorial empires. That's really the key point about why that should be so. And there are subsidiary points that I try to mention. One of these is, of course, that empires provide public goods. That is to say, the many illustrations of what we refer to as a public good, let us say protection, to take an obvious one, all states provide public goods of one kind or another, be it infrastructure or education or something like that. But empires spread across borders, and it's by their protection activities, among other things, that they are supplying public goods which facilitate the spread of globalizing influences.
What do you mean exactly by your statement referring to, quote, the transformative crises of the late 18th, 19th, and mid-20th centuries?
Right. You've put your finger there on what is really the dynamic or the motor of the book. And you must halt me if my answer gets prolix or indeed untrammeled, because I may lose my thread. But basically, these three crises, as I see them, which in themselves are scarcely unknown, but I formulate them in a way that puts them in the history of globalization. These are, as I mentioned, the dynamic that moves history forward. So to understand that dynamic, we have to just step back to the three propositions that underlie the whole book, which follow from the argument that you suggested I should summarize just a minute or two ago. So there are three propositions, and the one that relates to globalization is that there is a history to globalization which historians have not yet, odd though it may seem, explored fully. So we have a question that social scientists also ask, and that is not only when it began, but whenever we agree globalization began, what was its evolution over time? Is it something that simply gets bigger without changing its character? Or is it something that has different phases, each identified by having different structural characteristics? Now, my argument is that globalization, at least during relatively modern times, consisted of three phases. One I call proto-globalization, the other I call modern globalization, and the third I call post-colonial globalization. And I can elaborate on those in a second if you wish me to. But just to link that proposition with ones we've discussed, my second prop in this argument is to say, to come back to the point I made, that it is empires that are crucial to the process of not only globalization in general, but to these three stages which characterize it. And the final element in that is to say that once these phases get underway, they are travel through a dialectical process by which their very success, in inverted commas, of creating forces of expansion, in some cases of prosperity, of greater complexity, let's settle for that, and the areas they reach, throws up forces which eventually are in a position, should they choose, and they did in the end, to overturn either violently or to make some form of smoother transition from one form of globalization to the other. I'll halt at that point because those are very big concepts that each one, of course, needs unpacking, and I'll allow you to prompt me if you wish to say any more on any one of those matters that I've discussed.
Well, actually, looking at it from the perspective of the 18th century, or late 18th century crisis, could you explain for the audience why the so-called fiscal military state was so important, particularly in the case of the UK, and why its crises in the late 18th century, affecting particularly France and the UK, was so important?
Yes, I'm very glad you asked that. It's a good question in itself, and it gives me the opportunity to illustrate one of these phases. Obviously, there are two more to follow, which we may or may not wish to discuss or have the time to discuss. So the situation in the 18th century in Western Europe is of the rise of a form of state which historians have come increasingly to refer to as a military fiscal state. Now, all states have a military and all states have a fiscality. That goes almost without saying. The distinctiveness of the label for this period, however, is that it draws attention to structural changes taking place through much of Europe from about the 16th century onwards, which began to expand, certainly it's late 17th and through the 18th century. And as I say, and I'm not the only person to say this, I'm happy to say, namely that what happens in the late 18th century is that these forces come together in such a way as to create what I call a fiscal crisis. So why did they do this? Why was there this concentration of power and this increased resolution to secure the revenues, which often led to not only the expansion of trade, but to the expansion of warfare, the 18th century being one of the most embattled centuries of Western Europe until the 20th century, when we'd learned how to do it all much better or much worse. So the gunpowder revolution lies at the foot of this, at the basis of this development. Gunpowder transformed the means of coercion, and that was fine if you could afford to have the standing armies that went along with that, but particularly the capital cost of investing in cannon, maintaining, and so on and so on. So there was a form of arms race, especially in the 18th century, which Montesquieu drew our attention to very specifically, whereby states were having to defend themselves or, in some cases, wish to expand on the basis of the gunpowder revolution, their adaptation to it. This led to an increased centralization. And the centralization was related also to the need for revenues, either to grasp revenues from taxable peasantry within the state or to expand beyond it in order to capture taxation from sources which were either conquered or made in some way subordinate. So the 18th century saw increasing centralization, the growth of a bureaucracy to administer this, and of much greater disposal of armaments and resources put to warfare. One has to remember that another consideration for the definition of the military fiscal state is that these were states at this time without modern industry. They had handicrafts, they had long-distance commerce and local markets, of course, but they were basically agricultural. And the other aspect of them was they were also still dynastic states. So what you have then are what used to be called an ancien regime, if you like, but is, I think, rather too general a term to describe the diversity. And also it doesn't capture the movement and the development which I have tried to sketch for you. And when these states became embattled seriously with the Seven Years' War, 1756 to 63, and then, of course, with the American Revolution, 1776, another further series of warfare in which the Spanish, the French, and the Dutch participated and, in a sense, shot themselves in the foot because the costs of participation in that war from 1778-ish onwards helped to fuel the revolutions that took place in many parts of Europe, of course, beginning with France in 1789. So what you have in the late 19th century is literally a fiscal crisis whereby the costs of military expansion added to the need to police those areas in what became the United States, but specifically that you've already brought under control, that created a fiscal crisis because you couldn't generate the revenues without arousing huge discontent to balance the books. And it was that fiscal crisis that underpinned the revolutions of the late 18th century.
You write concerning the American aspect of what you just discussed, that, quote, the American Revolution was an Anglo-settler revolt led principally by gentlemen of property. Can you explicate that a little bit?
Yes, I think the point I'm trying to make, and it's in a way it sounds, as you put it, and you put it quite accurately, rather unsubtle. So, of course, I'm aware that the revolution has been endlessly and creatively studied by many, many fine scholars, and I'm not dissenting from their work. So, you know, we now know about the role of towns, of the history from below of the revolution, and so on. So I'm not trying to step away, still less step back from that. But I am trying to argue that what was happening in the late 18th century in what became the United States was rather typical of the general conditions that I've just tried to describe. So a settler revolution, yes, the point I'm trying to make there is that this was not something led or actually motivated primarily, that's the important qualification, by the many people who participated in the revolution, but was led, and I don't think this is too controversial or controversial at all, by men of substance, men of property, the Adamses, Jefferson himself, and so Washington too, and many others. And at the end of one of the chapters I have on this matter, I make the point to underline the observation you've made that this was not, strictly speaking, a revolution. Of course, it's called that, and I don't want to dispute some of the authenticity of that, of course. But I refer to it as a secession. The revolutionaries were not attempting to overthrow the church and state, though that is what happened in the end, but they were seeking to reclaim rights they thought they had and that the British were trying to take back from them. In that sense, it was a conservative secessionist movement that turned into a revolution in the sense of constitutions, anyway, and was led by the gentry we have referred to.
So, in essence, an American version almost Nabokovian sense of what happened in the UK in 1689.
Well, that's very well put. I would say there's a lot of strength in that position, and I would argue for long lines of continuity between the British and the settler experiences, not only before 1776, but thereafter too, because settler societies, whether it's Canada, Australia, the mainland colonies, do not readily throw off the influences and connections that made them what they were. And so you would expect to find lots of continuity, and of course you do. So that too can be considered to be some change of emphasis from at least some ways of looking at the revolution. And just add to that that a really important point in the historiography is that after 1783, there is a parting of the ways. The historians of empire and those who specialize in what is known in the books and in the programs as colonial history, they finish. They go away. 1783, you hand over the baton to a new set of people whose study goes through some point in the 19th century, and their study is of the rise of an independent republic. Whereas the British scholars, essentially, who have been looking at the 18th century as an extension of the British Empire, after 1783, they too pack their bags and disappear because they've got plenty to do. They've got to colonize Australia. They've got to understand India. So there is this parting of the ways, which runs quite counter to the history, actually, of all settler societies. Because, as I've said, it's the continuities that emerge in nearly every case. And so what I've tried to do, and I don't want to advance too far in this matter, but what I've tried to do after 1783 is to make the point that there is a difference between formal decolonization and effective decolonization. In 1783, the United States became formally independent, but it did not necessarily acquire full or even extensive effective independence. So the argument for the first half of the 19th century down to the Civil War is that these long lines of continuity are worth perceiving, pursuing, and emphasizing. And I try to do that in one of my chapters.
So in essence, it would be accurate to say that you are to a good extent an upholder of continuity versus discontinuity. Discontinuity, of course, being, I would say, the default position of most American historians who are looking at American history post-1783.
Yes, I think that's right. Again, it's all a matter of balance and emphasis, and all I would add to what I've said so far on that is that it seems to me factually correct that, if to take one example, if you look at the 18th century Anglo-American relations, then there are books and discussions of what is called the Atlantic world or the Atlantic complex, and historians have done a fantastic job showing the interconnections, cultural, political, economic, etc., etc. If you ask the question, okay, what happens to that complex, diverse, important Atlantic world after 1783? The answer is that it almost disappears. Now, of course, in reality, it doesn't disappear, but it disappears or is given a minimal place in most of the books because, as I have said, what matters after 1783 to most historians, and it's very important indeed, is the development of the new republic, the creation of a state, what kind of a state, expansion west and south, and so on. So I think that it is worthwhile drawing attention to the continuity of this Atlantic world, of its importance, and indeed, if you take the economic aspects of this, you can argue, and Jeremy Bentham saw the point in 1793, you can argue that economically these connections grew rather than diminished after 1783. Bentham himself said, we thought we were doing very well under the mercantilist regime. This was still as early as 1793, but he said, look what's happened in the years since independence. Our trade, the British trade, has grown even more than ever. Our relationships are really recovered very well. And the Louisiana Purchase in 1803 was made possible by Barings, who became the official agents, financial agents for the new American government. So, and then culturally, too, you could see all signs of continuity. So I don't want to overdo what I have tried to explain in this very necessarily cryptic way, but the essential point is, yes, these continuities can be pursued through political, economic, and cultural themes through at least to the Civil War.
And post-Civil War, why would you say that the American attempt at overseas expansion in the period 1865 to roughly mid-1890s failed rather than succeeded?
Yes. Again, you touch on a very important point of historical interpretation. What I will do to try and set this up, I hope, in a way that isn't too biased towards myself, but it will be evident if it is. What I'll do is just give a sentence or two about how this is often looked at. There are two ways of looking at the expansion of the United States, and I'm going to just leave aside for the moment continental expansion. I say leave it aside because, of course, it was the most important form of expansion, and you can argue, and I would argue, that it was that occupied the greater part of the energies and resources of the federal state and indeed the state governments through the 19th century. Looked at in that way, you can say that by the time you get to the Great War with Spain in 1898, overseas expansion was on a very limited scale. And indeed, a very famous scholar in the early 20th century coined the phrase that this was an aberration, a departure in 1898 from the normal course of U.S. history, which would then resume. Now, that's one view. You've got an aberration and you've got rather limited expansion except within the continent. A second view is that this continental expansion was central to an understanding of the subsequent, i.e. 20th century expansion globally of the United States. You've got these not just precursors, but causative elements developing in U.S. history, which have to take account. From that point of view, continental and allied expansion overseas flowed into the story of 1898. There was a continuum there which helps to explain 1898 and subsequent developments. Now, on that front, I would make two points. Firstly, outside the United States, there were tentative expansionist impulses, it's true, but they didn't really get anywhere. Commander Perry in Tokyo Bay in the 1850s was an important development, but Japan wasn't colonized and there was nothing really coming from that. He wanted to take Formosa. The Senate didn't want that. There were these schemes to annex Cuba, but they came to nothing. There was some preliminary exploration and filibustering in Central America, of course. All that is true. There was some involvement in the Barbary Coast. But when you said that, there's not much left, actually. So you have to rely on the argument that continental expansion fed into 1898. And here I would say that while it is perfectly true that you see in the development and the creation and further development of the U.S. state a predisposition towards the use of force, among other things, because the Native Americans had to be dealt with and land colonized and so on, it's going too far to suggest that you can then almost naturally, certainly easily explain 1898, and I'll just tell you now why that is the case. What I think happened after the Civil War was not the immediate unification of the once divided country, or the recently divided country. We now know that it took a long time to get the act together. So we're talking of going into the 1880s and beyond. This is still a fragile state, but it's reached a political accommodation, so there is still going to be one state with states' rights in many respects, so not slavery, of course, reaffirmed. So far, so good. But this development was itself interrupted, and here I make the point with emphasis, by entirely novel forces, forces that were not present in the first half of the 19th century, forces that until the 1870s and 80s cannot be fed into the story of expansion west and south. These forces were industrialization and the further development of the sense of nationalism, and not which rode over and expanded on the concept of national unity. Now, both these were battles. You didn't create national unity overnight, and it was extraordinarily difficult because of massive immigrants coming in. The world had changed when people, most of the immigrants or the settlers in the States had come from the British Isles. You've got Germans, you've got Scandinavians, etc., etc. Many of them couldn't speak English. So this posed huge problems of national unification. At the same time, the development of industry in parallel with that going on in Europe, almost year by year, the development of industry threw up new towns, new social forces, completely divorced from the land, and threw up further consideration of how these people were to be contained. So to put this very crudely, or briefly anyway, there was a disjunction between the need of economic development, which was the expansion of the market, the mobility of labor, etc., and the needs of political unity, which were to control some of these things and harness them for the common good. So when we talk of long continuities of continental expansion, I think we have to halt and recognize that these forces that I just referred to, of what I'm turning modern globalization, developing after 1850, were the ones that have to be accounted for in understanding why the United States created its own territorial empire overseas in 1898. And one last point, which is really important, and I'm glad I've just remembered it. If you take the decade of the 1860s, what's going on in the world in the 1860s? Well, of course, if we're looking at the United States, it's the end of the Civil War in 1865. And we can add to that that this is the beginnings, at least, of the realizable aspiration for uniting the country on a permanent basis. Okay, what's going on in Europe? Germany, Italy were united for the first time in that decade. France, after the defeat of the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, set about a series of major reforms. Even Britain, following its long, slow, liberal, evolutionary, Burkean trajectory, had a major, major political reform, expanding the franchise in 1867. And further afield, of course, we have the Meiji Restoration of 1868. In short, what was going on in the United States in the 1860s, where you can see clear moves towards the unification of the polity, accompanied subsequently, but as a result of that unification, accompanying it, the development of modern industry, exactly the same processes were underway in the major states of Europe and beginning in the first of the great states of Asia, Japan, at that same time. So when you go through to the late 19th century, you have all of these powers grappling with the more or less identical problems. How to maintain a political unity in an era in which the franchise had to be expanded, and how to maintain social control in an era in which modern industry and towns were threatening to disrupt it. That doesn't explain 1898, but it is the starting point for an explanation.
Going back to or concentrating on 1898 and the war with Spain, would you say that what would you say was a more important variable in terms of the causation of the war? Contingency of political events in Washington and Madrid, or for that matter, Havana, or economic determinism?
Yes. Well, I will say neither, but hope to try and put some elements of both together. The most influential book on 1898, and it is a wonderful book, is that by Lefebvre. And Lefebvre's book of, well, I think it's 1969, written at the height of new left influence of that time, as a branch of the so-called Wisconsin school, put very well what many others at the time were also arguing, namely that 1898 was a result of a quest for markets abroad at a time of industrial depression. So Lefebvre and others drew attention to what they would call, and we can call non-pejoratively, capitalist development of an industrial kind. They also drew attention to the crisis of capitalism, so-called, in the late 19th century, and they linked with that a search for markets. Now, that view was and has been contested, and I think it lacks any of the younger generation to refuel it, if that's possible. And the alternative views have come to the fore, and I won't run through all of them, but just give you a flavor of them. So you're quite right in drawing attention to the fact that some scholars emphasize the role of particular individuals, whether it's McKinley as president or a dozen others, and emphasize the role of human action as opposed to economic determinism. Others, more recently, like Christian Hogensen, have drawn attention to the supposed cultural features of imperialism, the fact, so it is said, that men were concerned about losing their vitality, and that the war was something which would restore them, and so on. Now, my view is somewhat different from that, and I think the problem with the economic interpretation as it has been expressed is that the areas that were colonized were of no use whatsoever in terms of markets, and they had no prospect, no one knew anyway, whether they had gold or oil, and they had neither in the event. And these were poor, war-torn countries, and it seems to me, and it always has seemed to me, to be incredible to suppose that that businessmen would search in Cuba and Puerto Rico for the markets that allegedly they couldn't have at home. Now, the counter to that is to say, well, that may be so, but it was their perception that this was the case. So they acted on the perception, they pushed the government. I don't think that argument actually now can be sustained. Does it mean that we then push back to an alternative argument of the kind that I've suggested, namely that it's really about a multi-causal approach and of individuals and so on and so on? We need to find a way, I think, of linking these two things together. And what I've done is to suggest the following. The forces that I've identified, namely those of industrialization, of increasing immigration, of social upheaval, and of the undisputed political, social, economic disputes, strikes, riots, and so on of the characterized the 80s and 90s clearly have a bearing on what is going on, not only leading to the War of 1898, but politics generally. So that would be my starting point. The question is, what sort of bearing did it have? And here, what I argue, and I certainly don't want to claim originality for this, but what I'm arguing is that the set of very well-known figures who we all know were actively involved, Theodore Roosevelt, Alfred Mahn, Lodge, Beveridge, these important politicos of the time, were indeed banging the drum for empire. So the question is, what was the relationship, if any, between their desire for empire and the forces that I have indicated? Now, it seems to me that it is quite mistaken to suppose that they were in some way tools of an industrial bourgeoisie, or however you wish to make it. That I don't think is an argument that can stand up. What were they interested in? They were looking about them, and they saw a formally united state after the Civil War coming under such pressure to make it not merely fragile, but on the point of splintering. The Pullman riots, the whole fiscal crisis of the 1890s, all of these things shook the fabric of the realm. And their view, as I see it, was that the role of empire was not to create new markets. It was not to restore the vitality of an elite, which already had plenty of vitality. It was an action calculated to unite the nation despite fissiparious tendencies that they saw around them. They were, in a way, conservative, but, to coin a phrase, progressive. That is to say, they wanted to do something that would halt what they really thought was a slide to revolution in the United States in the 1890s. At the same time, they were interested in maintaining the rule of the industrial order that had given them the positions that they had, but they recognized that it couldn't continue unchanged. So they were arguing for a form of reformed capitalism, and the role of 1898 was an intermediary one of acting as an act of national unification. And once that was achieved, the next phase of trying to moderate the system, which is what Theodore Roosevelt did after he assumed the presidency, of moderating the system while preserving it and preserving the role of the elites as the captains on the ship of state, that was what happened. And I think that is a way of bringing together the idiosyncratic and the individual with an understanding of these broader forces. And that's another reason to conclude why we need to pause before assuming or even arguing that the events of 1898 were themselves a product of a long-running continuity.
And getting into the issue of continuity versus discontinuity, in discussing the Great War and its aftermath, you appear to lean more towards the continuity end of the ledger. Why is that?
Yes. Well, to go back to the point we were discussing much earlier, the First World War has been seen conventionally as a turning point between imperial expansion and imperial decline. My argument here is that if you look at the events of the interwar period, you find that the war was fought for all sorts of reasons, but that the victors wanted to use their victory to conserve what they thought was in jeopardy. So the peace settlement and the actions of the colonial powers thereafter were those that are wholly consistent with the idea that empires were the highest stage of political life, that they were vectors of a civilizing mission to uplift other peoples, and that the imperial powers had a kind of racial as well as a civilizational, in other technical senses, justification for so doing. So those attitudes, which were common before 1914, persisted after 1914, right down and through to the end of the Civil War, the end of the World War II, minimally. So when you get to appeasement in the 1930s, Chamberlain and others thought nothing of giving away other people's territories, just as Lord Salisbury did in the 1880s. The whole imperial attitude was sustained. And if you look at the United States after 1917, we know, after the First World War, we know perfectly well that although the U.S. did not retreat into isolation in a very simple, crude way, we know that this was the intervention in the war of 1917 was not the precursor of an immediate or rapid involvement of the U.S. with the wider world. Certainly, you get examples of a spread into South America and already into Latin America and Central America. That's undoubtedly the case, but this is a regional expansion. The U.S. was not otherwise committed to an assertive, even an informal expansionist process.
You seem to argue, in terms of the overall gist of the book, that the American experience of empire in what you term the insular empire, the empire acquired, or the territories acquired after 1898, was similar to, rather than different from, the British and French experiences of that period. Why would you say that's the case?
Yes, it's a little counterintuitive at first sight, because you would think that the United States, a republican tradition as opposed to monarchical one, and the United States' formal empire consisted of a few islands which perhaps had special qualities and so on and so on. So there are there are ways of looking at this which at first sight suggest differences. But when you look in detail at the islands, and I'm referring now to the ones I've especially selected, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, Philippines, and I've used Cuba as a protectorate, the clearest example of protectorates. I've taken those four cases, which, by the way, even if you ignore Cuba, but the others account for 95-98% of the population of this, of the whole of the insular territories, including Alaska, incidentally. So we're not looking here at some outlier. These are very typical, the typical illustrations of the American territorial U.S. empire during the first half of the 20th century. A second point is that not only representative in that sense of the American empire, but it's easy to think of islands as recipients of greater forces, and it's often the case. But actually, these islands, and work on the Indian Ocean has shown that this point I'm about to make appears elsewhere too, islands can be seen as microcosms of much larger geographical areas. So when you look at the American empire and you ask yourself some of the key questions, was the ideology of rule any different from that of the British or French? The answer is no. Was the administration of rule any different? The answer is no. The U.S. had policies of direct and indirect rule, to use the terms. It had policies of association and assimilation. Again, I won't expand on the terms, just as the French and British did. The economy was identical in the sense that it was the classic exchange of raw materials such as sugar in particular, baka, pineapple, and so on, in exchange for manufactured goods, just as it was in the case of the British and the French empires. And it's worth remembering that just as the U.S. had trouble trying to grapple with the problem of the constitutional standing of these insular territories, as a republic that is, so too did the French. The French had exactly the same problems because they considered through their attitude and constitutional provisions as a republic were remarkably similar to those of the United States, and it posed the problem of what to do with these new areas. Would they become territories and have the right to incorporation? If not, what was their constitutional standing? So although the British case in that respect is rather different, the US can be compared, again in that respect, to the French Empire, and that comparison, to my knowledge, has never been made. So with those examples, you can see great similarities. And finally, perhaps the greatest similarity of all, is if you look again at the oscillations, the course of empire in the first half of the 20th century, it follows in the U.S. case exactly the development of the British and French empires. So you have the First World War, the first signs of nationalist discontent. After the First World War, the colonial powers reassert themselves in the United case of the United States as well as Britain and France through to the 1930s, which in all cases is a time of immense discontent, of riots, of violence because of the problems of primary producers. That's the time when the so-called green uprising takes place. That is to say, when the urban and urbane constitutional limited opposition to colonial rule begins to give way to mass discontent and the formation of nationalist movements on a mass scale, which were to emerge as major forces after World War II. And in the 1940s and 50s, the United States, for that reason partly, and also for reasons of the Cold War, decolonized its insular empire at precisely the time that the British and French were decolonizing their empires. I rest my case.
You state, following up that observation, that, quote, political youth in Asia brought colonial rule to a quick, if not entirely, peaceful end. Why was that?
Yes. The underlying reason, I think, is that after 1945, you can glimpse a development that began to expand in the 1950s and is with us today. And I refer here to the third phase of my story of globalization, what I've called post-colonial globalization. What's happening after 1945, I emphasize not immediately, but we can see it clearly in retrospect, was a change in the nature of the conditions that had underwritten the land-based, territorial, and insular empires that I've been referring to. The world economy began to change. Manufacturing started in Asia and in the settler colonies, of course, already in the United States, but was expanding in Australia, South Africa, Canada, New Zealand on a larger scale. It began actually in the 1930s. The world also had to grapple with new organizations. The United Nations are now sundry international organizations rising above individual nation states and claiming authority over matters such as, another novelty, human rights. So human rights, not just civil rights, which are politically defined for the most part, but human rights, meaning welfare, education, etc., these became ideals which increasingly, through the representation in the United Nations, became actionable and policed by the United Nations. Now, of course, in a sense, the United Nations had no power other than that of the constituent large nations, and that remains the case today. today, but increasingly the United Nations, allied to a new means of communication, was able to command what we will call the commanding heights of the kind of moral morality of the world. And this became of particular importance during the Cold War, when the Soviets were proclaiming an alternative ideology and suggesting that the trampled peoples of the world would do better to go communist. The US, Britain, France had to counter that in various ways. And one of the ways in which they countered it was by moving rapidly towards decolonization. So what you had after 1945 were really two sub-phases. After 1945, as after 1918, the colonial powers that had won decided that they wanted to resume normal service. And so the French and the British put a lot of money into the empire. They rejigged it. They thought that they could create a new phase of a collaborative, cooperative empire. We called ours the Commonwealth. The French called theirs the Union Française. This was a kind of schema to update empires. So you see there's continuity there. But what happened in the 1950s, there's not an exact date, but if you take the mid-1950s, say 1955 is a good enough date. By that time, the forces I've just referred to were having an effect, and the United States, which had backed the recovery of the Western empires after 1945, began to change its mind in order to, partly anyway, in order to deal with the challenges of the Cold War and of competitive coexistence. So after 1945, it seemed that the empires were a good thing for the future, for the stability of the West, and so on. In a short space of time, by the mid-1950s, the calculations had changed, and it became more important to try to work with the nationalists instead of suppressing them.
In your conclusion, you seem to argue that the American and British empires were different rather than similar. Why was that?
In the sense that I have spoken so far, the American empire that I refer to is the one that was last studied in 1962 in a book, an excellent book, by a man called Perkins. That is the empire of the territorial empire, as I'll call it, that is the empire of territory, of administrators, of the export crops, and so on and so on, that was created in 1898 and fell apart or was demolished in the 1950s. Now, that's an empire that actually can be compared with the British and French empires for the reasons that I've given. Now, the oddity to my mind, and here I should say that I'm a bit of an exception, the oddity, as I'm going to call it, is that exactly at the moment when the United States was losing or giving up its territorial empire, let's say, with the Cuban Revolt in 59 and the incorporation of Hawaii in 59, those are the two last of the so-called colonies, by that time, the United States, from my perspective and in my definition of empires, didn't have an empire. And it was exactly at that moment, or after 1945 anyway, when scholars begin to talk of the United States as an empire. So a lot here depends, turns on what definition you give to empire, and that's a huge topic that we may not have time to discuss. I have, I think, good reasons for adhering to the view that the empires of 1800 to 1950 were territorial, essentially. Now, my view is that the United States was indeed the leading world power from 1945 onwards, but it exercised its power in ways which were, you could call them imperial, but you can't say it was an empire. That is not a semantic division. It is possible to have imperialism. You can argue that the spread of U.S. influence and colonization across the United States in the 19th century was imperialist. You could argue that. But the net result was not an empire. That is perfectly consistent. So I think you can argue for forms of imperialism, if you so wish, after 1945, by which I would roughly mean the political intervention informally, the desire to influence other people's polities, and so on and so on. You could argue for that, but there was no empire, in my sense, created. I would further argue that the influence of the U.S. after 1945 was far less than it is conventionally ascribed to it. But that's a point that perhaps we don't have time to discuss. So if you're going to call the U.S. an empire after 1945, you are using the term in a way that does not permit comparison with previous territorial empires, which were brought about by conditions of globalization that made it not only possible but necessary to integrate other parts of the world for the reasons I've given. Those conditions didn't exist after 1945, again, for the reasons I've given. Changes in the economy, changes in world morality, rise of nationalism, etc. And so by calling it an empire, it seems to me that scholars perpetuate a confusion. And once you start calling the non-territorial empire, in inverted commas, of the United States an empire, then, of course, you get all these books that say, oh, well, are we the new Rome, etc. Now, that question presumes that you have a basis for comparison in which the units are sufficiently alike to make the basis, the comparison, possible. But they're not. They're entirely different. So some scholars, in reacting to this, have said, oh, well, we can call it an empire, possibly, but it was an empire of a different kind. I'm quoting. Well, if it was an empire of a different kind, what on earth does that mean? Perhaps it wasn't an empire at all. So I have fallen back on a term which I use with some diffidence, but it's not my term, of course. It's a term in the literature of saying that the United States was an aspiring hegemon, that is to say, a world leader during this time. And I use that term to differentiate the conditions which underlay the exercise of U.S. influence in the world after 1945 from the conditions that pertained from the centuries before then.
Professor, if you could, under 3 minutes, if there was one thing that you wanted the reader to take away from your book, what would it be?
Thank you. Yes, in under 3 minutes, I will try to do this. What I think I would say to the reader, or hope that the reader will at least consider, is this. And remember, I'm aiming at two sets of readers. The first set of readers are those who are U.S. specialists. The second set of readers are those who are specialists or interested in the history of empires, particularly, but not exclusively, Western empires. Now, I don't want to exaggerate what I'm about to say, but here is the appeal I would make. Notwithstanding the huge recognition and strides made by U.S. scholars in recognizing the need to look outward and to incorporate elements of globalization and so on, I think it's still true to say that there's a long way to go in that direction, and that one could even generalize that much of the main street attitudes are still particularly insular, and also that the scholarly level, understandably, scholarship is very heavily based on the United States and within the United States. So this is perfectly normal. It's perfectly understandable. All I would argue then is that on that point, that because we live in a globalized world, it might be profitable, certainly interesting, possibly illuminating, to take a view of U.S. history, which is it from the outside in, providing, of course, it understands just enough of the inside not to make a nonsense of a mountain of admirable scholarship. So I would hope that the U.S. my book will help U.S. readers to see themselves to a degree as others see them, or at least as this other sees them. And the second and final point is that imperial historians, historians of Western empires, as I have said already, give up very largely on the United States after 1783. True, there is work on the remaining colonies in the Caribbean. There are exceptions, etc., etc. But by and large, imperial historians look elsewhere. I do not know of a book of any kind of imperial history in French or English that actually says anything about the United States between 1783 and Pearl Harbor. And when it picks up on Pearl Harbor, it's all about the Cold War and decolonization. So what I'm saying to the imperial historians is that you too need to rethink your attitude towards empire. There was an empire here of two kinds. Britain's informal influence was extensive in the first half of the 19th century. The United States itself became an imperial power, creating an empire as others were too in the late 19th century. And most important of all, there's the forgotten empire, the insular empire that the U.S. created in 1898, dissolved in the 1950s, and no book on imperial history mentions that or gives it more than a paragraph if you're lucky. I want imperial historians to revise their view of the world as well to incorporate this newish, I hope, view of the U.S. experience.
Professor Hopkins, I would like to thank you very much. You've been wonderful here explicating your book. This is I can tell you myself, from my own experience of reading it, a voluminous, intricate book. And it's a first-class example of historical scholarship, which any reader from whatever background or historiographical tendencies will enjoy perusing and reading in depth. Thank you again very much. Charles Cutillo, New Books Network. Thank you again.
Thanks very much, Charles.